The meeting is officially called to order. Representative Crescia, would you move the minutes, please?
I will move the minutes as so printed.
Representative Crescia moves the minutes for March 5. Is there any discussion? Hearing none and seeing none, all those in favor say yes. Yes?
Yes.
See, I changed it this morning. Those who oppose, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved.
I almost said I had to vote twice, Madam.
Members, the first item for business this morning is moving my House File 1075 to the General Register. So I'll make that motion that I move 1075 to the General Register. I need a vehicle, members, so if you're trying to guess, I think we're used to this custom that you always, as a chair, like to have certain bills sitting on the General Register, and this is one I'd like to have there. If you do not recall, the substance of 1075 is lifting the exemption that they not continue with continuing education credits. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and 1075 has been sent to the General Register. Thank you, members. Our big bill today is House File 1392, Representative Bennett. Welcome to the testifying table, Representative Bennett, and if you would move House File 1392 to be referred to the Committee on Higher Education.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I move House File 1392 onto the Higher Ed Committee.
And you have no amendments, is that correct?
That's correct.
So please explain your bill.
Sure. Madam Chair and committee members, House File 1392 is a bill that would eliminate unnecessary double testing in grades 8, 10, and 11. And it addresses a concern that a number of schools have voiced, that the ACT tests are burdensome to the schools and not aligned to our state standards. So what it would do is cut back some of those ACT assessments in grades 8 through 12. It would restore the state standards writing in the high school, and it would maintain the high school science exam. There would be an optional ACT plus writing in grades 11 or 12 that would be paid for by the state, so that we don't have a burden on students that would have a hard time affording that test. This bill also asks the Chancellor of MNSCU, in consultation with the Commissioner of Education, to identify minimum scores for the MCAs that would demonstrate the students' readiness for certain college-level programs, a certificate-level program, a two-year college program, and a four-year college program. And I want to emphasize that these are not cut scores. I think that was a little confusing to some people. We are not trying to limit students from going on to college at all. I would not want this bill to do that. What it does, though, is gives students, parents, and schools more information on whether they are ready for that type of program. And as we all know, what we've heard in our committee from a number of students is some students get a surprise when they get to college and suddenly have to take remedial courses. For the so the idea of this is to give students more information by letting the MCAs report kind of some readiness scores for these different college programs. I do have a couple of testifiers, too. One is sick, but I have two other here. And actually, they're very special people because they're from my own school district where I've taught for many, many years. And
we'd welcome them to the table.
That would be wonderful. Come on up.
Please come forward, testifiers.
I do have one testifier who is ill today, and so the pages will distribute her testimony.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Yes. Members, I do believe we have at our places this testimony from Jolene Raymond. She's Assistant Director Principal of Goodhue County Education District. So thank you, Representative Bennett, mm-hmm. for providing us with this. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Mark Grossbaugh. I'm the Albert Lee High School Principal.
Well, it's so nice to have you here, and please proceed.
This morning, we have 240 eighth graders at Elbert Lee High School that are starting their marathon of testing over the next month and a half. An estimation by them taking the MCA math, reading, and science will take about 10 hours out of their academic days, which will be about 11.5 academic school days that they will miss out of by taking these tests. This fall, they've already taken the ACT Explore test, which added more time to their testing. I'm sure many of you have seen this chart from MDE. It lists all the tests high school students have to take well before they graduate. And in Elbert Lee, we have a great constituents that have supplied us with great access to computer labs, but our computer labs are tied up from basically March through the end of April now with testing. And so it takes a lot of time. It puts a lot of pressure on students. This doesn't count for makeup days, and so it's really a burdensome and stress on the students. As Ms. Representative Bent mentioned, our 11th graders are taking multiple tests. They're taking the math test this year, the MCA math test, and they're also taking the ACT plus writing test. And based on when those tests are available and preparation for students, it seems to the students that I've talked to is, why am I taking two tests within basically a month? What's the reason behind it? And so at the high school level, and as I've talked to teachers and colleagues, there's a lot of time spent getting ready for the test, not prepping for the test, but just getting ready for this month and a half journey. Like I mentioned, we start with science this morning, and it's basically turns the high school upside down just because of using computer labs, those type of things. So the more we can limit that would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Grossklaus. Welcome to our committee. Say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Mary Williams, Director of Teaching and Learning for Elbert Lee Area Schools. I, too, reiterate the need to look at reducing the amount of testing that we have. Here is the 312-page procedures manual that districts received last week. Testing began yesterday. And this is a responsibility of DACs, District Assessment Coordinators, and SACs, School Assessment Coordinators, to be knowledgeable of so that we are running these tests as they are intended. This is ridiculous, in my opinion, that we need to be perusing this type of manual every year, and it changes, and this year the administration is really tightened down because it is all online. So we have, just to add to that, our teachers need to watch an over a 65-minute training video to make sure we are assessing in a secure manner. They need to watch another 20-minute training video when they monitor the tests with the students. And then all the behind-the-scenes prep that it takes out of our days to get the labs ready, to do the proctor caching, to get the test session tickets available for students, to set up the test sessions. There's lots and lots of work that goes on behind the scenes, not just for the students taking the test, but for the employees that are preparing the labs and so forth. The staggered testing, when we jump from an eighth grade reading and then we don't assess again until 10th grade, and we jump from an eighth grade math and we don't assess again until 11th grade. In science, we do that in fifth, eighth, and then a high school science test. Those staggered pieces in assessment is not really quality information to inform our instruction. When you're looking at an eighth grade score and then you have a 10th grade student, we've lost a year of data in there for informing what we're doing in the classroom. Ideally, some sort of system that would allow us to monitor students' growth and inform our instruction on an ongoing basis, in my opinion, would be ideal, not just a summative assessment in the spring that we wait to have official results, usually in the middle to the end of August. So it's that delay in receiving those scores that removes some of the value for our teachers in using it to inform their instruction. As far as the college and career readiness assessments, I do believe there is value in providing our students with some sort of interest inventory, some sort of guidance for their future beyond high school. Having that option of the ACT for students, I see as value. And if we are to able to align the MCA scores, as Representative Bennett said, with the MinSQ system, that would be superb, and look at providing that information as early as we can, not just with the 10th and the 11th grade tests, but as early as the 6th and the 7th and the 8th grade tests. That's when students should begin analyzing what their futures may look like and prepare for courses they should take and remediation plans and so forth. So if we could roll some sort of package with all those pieces in one sort of Minnesota assessment system, that would obviously be ideal. I know we're a ways from doing that, but those are things I think that should be considered.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify in favor of House File 1392? Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 1392. We support House File 1392 for two primary reasons. One is practical. The other is for its innovative use of information. On the practical side, House File 1392 updates our student assessment laws to reflect the expiration of the 8th grade Explorer and the 10th grade plan exams. These have been discontinued by ACT. In addition, the Compass exam is eliminated, in part because it was combined with the Explorer and plan exams, and because it failed to meet its anticipated use as a diagnostic exam. In addition, the Department of Education found these exams and the ACT exam are not aligned with Minnesota's academic standards. As a result, House File 1392 updates our state assessment policies by focusing on measures of student progress relative to Minnesota's academic standards. This is critical because our standards are a description of what all students should know to be prepared for success after high school, and you need an aligned exam to give families, students, and educators accurate information on how well students are doing. Another benefit of using a state-developed exam, such as the MCA, rather than national exams, is we have control over such items as item development and review, types of allowable student accommodations, and even when the exams are given. On the innovative side, we think the language on page 6 will really help students and families. This provision asks the MinSCU system and MDE to identify high school MCA scores that indicate students are prepared to enter various levels of post-secondary education without remediation. The handout I provided is from the 2014 Getting Prepared report published by the Office of Higher Ed. And what it shows is that students who score proficient on the high school reading and math MCAs are far more likely to enroll in post-secondary education and are less likely to need remedial coursework. Obviously, these are two critical outcomes we all want for graduates. House File 1392 on page 6 will break out this information for students and families by various levels of post-secondary education, giving them more precise information on where they may be relative to where they want to go. An added benefit is that because this is based on MCA results, families will have early information on their students' performance, beginning as soon as the third grade, and can act accordingly. We'd like to thank Representative Bennett for proposing these practical and innovative changes and ask that you support House File 1392. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Are there others in the audience who have statements of support they'd like to offer? If not, are there those with concerns? Please come forward. So we'll go to questions. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Bartholomew.
Oh, Mr. Bartholomew, you're needed at the table. And perhaps you should stay there, and Representative Bennett, you'll be close at hand. So, Representative Yaruso.
Thank you. You just had a statement that the students who score proficient do better in college, basically. So what is our current percent of students who score proficient on the MCAs, to whichever test you were referring to when you made that statement?
Sure.
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Yaruso, I'm working off of memory, but I believe the percent students scoring proficient on the high school MCAs was a mid-60s probably in math and mid-70s in reading, but again, I'm off of the top of the head. The key is if we can get them to a proficient level, 90, especially in math, the correlation is very strong. 90% enroll in post-secondary education, and only 9% need remedial coursework. So the key is, whether we're there or not, we need to get them there, if at all possible.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, but the issue here is which test we use. And so as evidence that one test is better than another test, we need to compare things on the same basis. So if we were to take that same percentile group of people on another test, do you have the data for how those people do when they go to college? If we took only the top 60% or 70% scoring on any other test, do you have evidence that that does not distinguish people that go on and succeed in college?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Bureau, so I'm not sure I'm tracking exactly what you're asking. I do know the Getting Prepared report did have some information on ACT scores and student participation, I believe, in post-secondary. I think the greater point we're trying to make is that we have state standards that have been developed in partnership with higher education that are a link between the K-12 system and higher ed. And then we have the MCAs that assess those standards and student progress, and they actually show fairly well that if kids can perform at grade level on the K-12 standards, they are relatively seamlessly ready to enter post-secondary, and that's the key.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But my point is that kids that can score fairly well on many assessments succeed in college. And so that particular piece of information doesn't really tell us which test we should be using unless we have a side-by-side comparison of the predictive value of those various tests. And so standing alone, that statement, although is true, it doesn't necessarily follow that a state-developed test is superior to a nationally normed test in that sense. Now, I understand that you like it because it aligns with the state standards, but I have concerns because it costs us a lot of money to develop the state tests, and we have had ongoing issues in the past with items on the tests at times, with inability. You know, we've got these huge gaps in how kids perform, and I'm concerned that part of the issue there is when we develop state tests, we are restricting the number of questions that can be developed because it's a cost issue. We'll restrict the test bank. We restrict the pool of people over which the test has been normed. And that brings some problems. And so we've got these two things that we have to balance, the strict alignment with the state standards versus and the control over the timing, as you mentioned, versus the advantages that you gain in cost savings and statistical validity and so on with the nationally normed tests. In addition, we do have kids that move from state to state and whatnot, so it's not a huge issue, but it's one little side issue. So I really would like if we're going to draw conclusions, that we really need to have a logical progression of those conclusions. So it's just a statement of fact, it doesn't necessarily imply what a person says it implies. And in this case, I don't think the fact that students who do well on the MCAs do well in college is necessarily a point to prove that that's what we need to do, because I'll tell you, students who do well on the ACT do well in college, and students who do well on the SAT do well in college, and so on. So if we're going to use that kind of fact, we really need to have the side-by-side comparison for it. Thanks.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Yaruso, I guess two things. One, if we used a nationally normed assessment like the ACT and its products, for example, one of the things that we discovered through the testing committees that the department organized is we really lose a lot of control over testing issues as a state of Minnesota, because we contract with a third party to basically run our testing system. We're using ACT's test items. We run on their schedule, and our accommodations for kids are determined by ACT. As opposed to Minnesota, we're through the MCAs within psychometric norms, but we get to decide what those questions are. We get to review them for bias. We get to determine special ed accommodations on a much more flexible basis. And the other benefit to the MCAs is, and this was something that came up during the testing reduction task force, was kind of the exciting idea that the commissioner actually floated, was that if we could get higher ed to consider MCA scores as well as the ACT or anything else, they would get much more rich information on kids, because depending on how long the student's been in our system, they might have MCA results all the way back to the third grade. So you're going to have a really good history of where that kid has been, as opposed to just an ACT score in the 11th grade. And that was another possibility that, again, came up through those discussions and really seems to have a lot of promise.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. But the fact that we get to review the questions and we get to review them for bias and all that also means we have to do the questions and we have to, and this is where some of the costs come from. And I am concerned about that, because nationwide testing is taking up more and more and more educational dollars all the time. And it's not like we're paying ourselves to do it, because that money does go out to a third party. And I've got to believe that if that third party can do individual contracts for different tests in every state they deal with, that's going to be more money, not less. And I'm also really not the idea that your college admissions would look back to the third grade terrifies me. There are lots of kids who need lots of help along the way, and they are late bloomers and don't figure it out until later. And I don't think, as a parent of a third grader, that I want to have my kid having their school records in the third grade end up being part of a college admission. So I frankly don't see that as a benefit. That's all.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a number of questions for Representative Bennett. But before I do, are we going to hear from the Department of Education on this bill?
I called for other testifiers, so I would hope so.
Madam Chair, I would hope so as well. Representative Bennett, I have several questions. So on line 415 of 416, we eliminate language that says students are not required to achieve a specific score or level of proficiency on an assessment under this provision to graduate from high school. Are we offsetting that language with a similar expectation for this new regime of testing? And I guess more broadly, what is your intent relative to that language?
Representative Bennett.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Mariani, what we're doing here is taking this language out, which allows the Commissioner of Education and the schools to come up with that level of proficiency. So the intent is to allow the commissioner, with input from schools and experts, to address this particular point.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Mariani.
Representative Bennett, what is your intent then in terms of a specified score or level of proficiency for the sake of graduation?
Representative Bennett.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. My intent, Representative Mariani, would be to allow the experts to decide that, because I wouldn't feel like I was qualified to really choose a proficiency level. So that would be up to the commissioner and the Board of Education and schools.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, is it within that, is it your intent to reinstate a cut score for the sake of a high stakes cut score for the sake of obtaining a high school graduation?
Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I personally am not in favor of cut scores. I know as a student, when I was in eighth grade, and we're talking about even, you know, looking back to earlier grades to start trajectory, I would not have probably even gone to college had they had cut scores back then. So, no, I would not like to see cut scores, because I don't think assessments always get at the actual student. I mean, for most students, they do, but we have students who just aren't good test takers. We have students, like I was at one point, whose family was going through emotional difficulties, and I was not a good test taker at that time either, so I would not be in favor of cut scores.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Representative Bennett, you and I are kindred spirits on that issue. And in fact, this legislature spent a number of years arguing over that point. I've been here long enough that I was actually sitting in Representative Erickson's chair when we passed the high stakes cut score. And frankly, it was one of the biggest mistakes that I've ever made as a chairperson or a legislator. It didn't take us very long to discover that what we had done was set up a number of students to basically never get a high school diploma. And we spent several years going over that issue. Representative Bennett, on page 6, we have the MNSCU. And Madam Chair, are we going to hear from MNSCU on this bill?
You know, Representative Mariani, I called for others to come forward, so they are welcome to come forward.
Madam Chair, are we sending this bill?
We are sending this bill to MNSCU, yes, to higher ed. Yes, all the way to MNSCU, yes. Yes, this bill will go to higher ed next. And MNSCU can weigh in, but if they're in the audience, they can weigh in today, too.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam
Please
Chair.
Please proceed.
It would be better if MNSCU weighed in this committee. And not only at the higher ed committee. So I'm disappointed that they're not here to speak to this issue, because I certainly would like to know how they plan to do this and what the timeline is, when they expect to have this happen. That goes to the issue of whether or not we should be legislating ahead of knowing, you know, what their result is going to be. It seems like we're kind of jumping pretty quickly here based on something that hasn't been produced. But Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, in regards to those lines, is it your intent, and I know you've already expressed your intent and your feelings about a cut score, high stakes cut score, but in regards to that language, do you expect a high stakes cut score to come out of that directive from MNSCU and the commission?
Representative Bennett.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, thank you. I absolutely do not want this to become a cut score. It is solely for giving information to students and parents in schools to give general guidelines as to, for example, if you had a particular score on the MCAs, this would be a score that you do well, knowing you do well at a two-year program or a four-year program. Or if you have this score, it means you're going to have a tough time in this four-year program. Certainly, I would not want to limit any students from going forward, again, for the reasons I mentioned before. So if there is language that I could put in here that made it really clear that this is not a cut score, I would be very willing to put that in. I also discuss this with other people. So, no, definitely it should be just information, not a cut score.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Mariani.
And Representative Bennett, I'll certainly take you up on that offer. It seems to me that the way the entire bill is structured, as opposed to very specific language, it raises questions about whether or not, because we talk about high school graduation requirements in this bill, whether or not we are in fact setting up a cut score situation here. I understand the intent that you're trying to do. I think it's somewhat similar to the intent when we changed this just a few years ago to be able to focus on career and college readiness diagnostic information for students. In other words, partly of part of the things that Mr. Bartholomew argued have already been put into the statute. The issue really has to do with the implosion of the ACT test as the instrument, but it has been the intent of this legislature, at least for the last 4 years, and I hope it will continue to be, that in regards to our assessment system, our desire isn't to get closer to NCLB. We heard Ms. Williams speak earlier about, quite frankly, the uselessness of a summative test, particularly given at the end of the year. What she's looking for is informative tests that inform her instruction, and I think she also sees value in assessments that actually arm students with valuable information. And so if that's the intent of this bill, then I will certainly work with you in this regard. But I think there may be issues in terms of how the entire bill is structured relative to the high school graduation requirements. Madam Chair, I'm wondering if the department wouldn't come down and answer a couple of questions for me.
Representative Mariani, they're coming. Welcome, Mr. McHenry, to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Education.
Please proceed. Did you hear, have you asked your question yet?
I think
he suggested what it is, but go ahead and ask it directly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first big obvious question is what the department's position is relative to this bill.
Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, we appreciate, first of all, having the discussion around assessments. We know that's a very important discussion. We've entered into that the last few years to make sure the assessments that we're giving to students are providing the best information possible for actual students and teachers and parents to make decisions. Right now, we are building our tests so we can provide information in a much quicker manner. We actually have information that we can give to students and teachers within 48 hours. The delay on times that we hear a lot of times is based on we're confirming data and we're actually giving school-wide data and district-wide data. Specifically to this bill, you'll see on
Thursday,
that the department and the administration have a different perspective on testing than this bill. There are issues that the author has raised regarding specific tests in the battery of tests from the ACT, including Explore and Plan, that we understand that those tests are actually going away and being replaced by a different battery of tests. We worked over the interim specifically just on test reduction, where we brought forth professionals in the education field, parents, advocates, folks in higher ed to really take a look at what some of the best options are and have reviewed those options. So one area that we do agree on is that the Explore, Plan, and Compass may not be the appropriate test to give, considering that those are going away. But specifically on this bill, a couple of things that we did want to raise that we're actually struggling with ourselves, as we want to provide some more flexibility for districts and teachers around the ACT. We see the ACT is a very valuable test. We don't believe there's a need for a specific minimum score, as colleges from different levels actually make the determination of what the appropriate score would be. As far as having some flexibility, Mr. Bartholomew raised some issues around what the ACT can and can't do. Obviously, it's a nationally recognized test, so it's something that can be that students can see as a value as they're taking that test of how that specifically helps them. We feel that that is really important to continue to have as an option. The idea in lines 425 through 27 talks about the issue of having an option of having it in 11th or 12th grade. That's something that we're looking into right now as far as the contract we have with ACT. Right now we do have one specific date for the ACT in 11th grade on April 28th, and we have a makeup date. By expanding additional dates, there's a cost that can be associated with that. So that's something that we're actually working to try to determine specifically what that cost could be. On lines 521 and 22, it deletes language around alternative assessments given under the college entrance exam. I think what we want to do is just make sure that we're allowing all students the opportunity to take a test in the format that they want. So I guess that's one of the things that I think we'd want to figure out a little bit more moving forward. And then the issue that you've already hit on, Representative Mariani, around 610 through 616, I think what we were trying to do is listen to the conversation to understand what the intent of having those specific, the separate tiered minimum scores. Again, we feel that it's important to make sure that the tests that we're given have good information, and we're giving that back to the teacher immediately as the teacher and the student and the parents are making the decision of what needs to happen for specific interventions so a student can continue to improve. And we feel that having those different tiers we didn't understand if that was a cut score or what the minimum score was all about. So that's something that that we would have some concern with. But again, I think that we're going to have, you're going to hear from us on our proposal, and I think that's going to be an area that we'll, that'll be the test proposal that we will be supporting. But we're very open to working with this committee and with you, Madam Chair, and other members of this committee to make sure that we can continue to have the best assessment system moving forward that does provide timely and good information to students and to parents and to teachers.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. McHenry. So I hear a lot of concerns with the bill on a number of issues. I thank you for sharing that. I just want to be real clear for today's sake, for this hearing. Madam Chair, is our motion today to move this bill or to lay it over? Or
to move it to higher ed.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, it's all more important that we fully vet as much as we can, because this is the committee that should be doing the fully vetting of this, and frankly no other committee. So I just want to be really clear. Is the commissioner saying that she will not support any language that establishes a high-stakes cut score?
Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, again, that's not something that the commissioner is not in support of a specific cut score for our assessment system to have a nationally recognized college entrance exam as the ACT of what we do have. Those scores are determined by the individual colleges. So we see that the value of having those specific scores are determined by the colleges as students are going to move forward. One other area I did forget to mention as I'm looking in this area on 610, as far as having the Chancellor of Minskew, again, I know this is going to higher ed, but having the Chancellor of Minskew determine the specific scores, although it's in consultation with the Commissioner, again, it's the Department of Education working with stakeholders that are setting our specific, that are developing our standards. And so it would seem that having Minskew develop what these minimum scores would be, rather than in consultation with the commissioner, it seems like that should at least be reversed. And then it doesn't include the University of Minnesota. So on that, it seems like that as far as determining those minimum scores, that's another area of concern that we just wanted to raise.
Madam Chair.
Well, Mr. McHenry, we're trying to make seamless, though, the relationship between K-12 and higher ed, and this is one of our efforts to do that. Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Mr. McHenry, I do share the chair's vision about a seamless secondary and post-secondary system, but I think you raised an appropriate question about where the proper decision-makers should lie relative to what it's going to take to obtain a high school diploma and credential. I don't think it's in the Minskew system or the University of Minnesota, or frankly in the business partnership. I think it's in the K-12 system, and I think it's in this committee. Mr. McHenry, and again, members, the reason I'm asking this question does have to do with the history, and I refer you again back to the language of line 415 and 16, which eliminates very specific legislative language relative to this issue of a high stakes cut score. And I don't see any replacement for that language anywhere here. I would also refer members further down the lines 515 to 520. where, and I understand that, I understand the structure of the bill, you know, we've got this issue with the ACT, you know, suites because they're going away. However, members, look at that language really carefully. That has to do with diagnostic information where the legislature is quite clear that the purpose of this legislation is to empower students, to empower families. And so the big philosophical question for us here right now, it seems to me, is whether or not it is our intent to disempower students and disempower families. I think it's really pretty simple in that regard. So if you look at the language, it talks about diagnostic exam relative to the college career placement diagnostics that can then be used for targeted instruction. So that's to Ms. Williams' argument, a person in the field earlier, to intervention, for remediation, et cetera. And so it seems to me that, and I need to look at the bill much more carefully, this is highly technical, but it seems to me that we need to slow down here to make sure that we're not walking away from the commitment to have that kind of information for students. But Mr. McHenry, I want to throw you a question on line 533 to 536. This is where the legislature had directed the department to do a study about the alignment between the assessments that were at that point, they're still on the books, relative to our standards, and then also relative to the requirements under the federal government. Was that study ever done?
Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, yes, that study has been done. One of the requirements in the contract signed with the vendor did not specifically allow us to have that published. So the study has been done, but unfortunately, for legal reasons, I'm not in a position to publicize that study.
Madam Chair, Mr. McHenry,
Representative Mariani,
I appreciate the information. I knew that answer. And members, you know, this is what we're dealing with. And there's an up and a down in terms of what we're dealing with in terms of engaging with experts, if you will, and probably much more efficient than if we developed an entire testing development. I get that system. So we're dealing with private vendors. However, by virtue of that relationship, we're put in a position where you all who make decisions, and this will come back again and again and again, so long as we have those relationships, you know, you're all put in a position of not giving the information that you absolutely need to have representing your people in order to make sure that we have the proper policy frame here for our students. So add all these components together. You know, we're taking away all sorts of diagnostic information in this bill, at least in the language. We asked for a study from the department, directed them to work with those vendors, and the department's coming back and saying, hey, the vendors won't give us that information. You know, it seems to me, and Mr. McHenry, this is not a personal thing with you, but it seems to me that our executive branch is really pretty inept, quite frankly, in terms of carrying out the people's will here. And then, Mr. McHenry, in that same language, did we request then, or did we not request, of the federal government for approval relative to our reflection of the standards in this language? Did we make that request to the federal government as the legislature directed the executive branch to do and as the governor who signed a bill also expected his Department of Education to do?
Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, the request for any waiver from the federal government, that is something that's a continued effort between our deputy commissioner and commissioner with the Secretary of Education. So that's an ongoing discussion as far as what we would be able, what we could be allowed for a federal waiver or not. So that's an ongoing discussion we continue to have with the feds.
Representative Mariani.
So Madam Chair, members, so it wasn't done. So you all passed the law and you directed the department to do this work and it hasn't been done. I mean, that's the answer here. And if you're concerned about NCLB and Washington, D.C.'s control over our student assessment system, which frankly means control over our schools, you know, this is the language that attempts to give us an ability to distance ourselves independently based on your knowledge as legislators, and we've requested the executive branch to move on this, and it hasn't been done. And now we're asking this bill to come and totally change our student assessment system without the information that we requested of the executive branch to be able to make intelligent decisions here. So members, I mean, the pickle here, Madam Chair, is, of course, as you know, the ACT is backing out of the very instruments that we're depending on to be able to do that. So we're, again, dependent on a private sector decision, not a public policy decision, but a private sector decision. So obviously we have to do something. But I have to say, Madam Chair, members, I am terribly, terribly concerned with what we're doing on a number of fronts, including, quite frankly, our disempowering ourselves relative to taking control of our student assessment system. And again, Madam Chair, if we don't control our assessment system, we don't control our schools. You heard that from the testimony earlier about what happens in actually running a school on a day-to-day basis, setting up the schedule. You know, it's all around those big assessments, which we have little control over, which the original language here sought to begin this struggle. This is not pointing fingers at anything. It's just laying out the reality here. And so, members, I really want us to slow down here and spend much more time having the dive into this discussion as opposed to rushing. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I shouldn't say that language. As opposed to moving this bill out of this committee until we have a much deeper interaction with the department. I think we ought to have the MISCU system come in as well. And frankly, I'd like to hear from the test reduction group. You know, all this work started several years ago when you had a testing, Mr. McHenry, a testing advisor group that came in and said, among other things, you know, get us out of these high-stakes, you know, scenarios. Our state, for most of its history, never had a high-stakes graduation expectation, and yet we produce one of the most powerful, you know, education-driven states in the nation. And now we're being told by the Business Partnership and others that you have to have a high stakes if we're going to be economically competitive. You know, I think we ought to debate that. I think it ought to happen in this committee. So, Madam Chair, I have lots of other questions, but I've already extended your patience.
Representative Bennett.
Madam Chair.
And so I'll stop at this point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a couple of points. First of all, we have heard from the Test Reduction Advisory Group, and I'll give you their recommendations here. They said to continue the use of the MCAs in grades 3 through 8 for reading and math, continue use of MCAs in grade 5 through 8, or 5 and 8, excuse me, for science, continued use of MCAs in grade 10 for reading and grade 11 for math, continued administration of the ACT plus rating in either grades 11 or 12, recommendation not clear if this remains a graduation required test, but absence of an MCA writing or separate science exam implies state mandate, develop and administer one career interest survey in grades 8 and 10. So they are recommending, and then the tests eliminated by a working group, eliminate the career and college readiness assessments for reading, writing, math in grade 8, that's the ACT Explore, and grade 10, that's the ACT Plan, as well as the grade 10 diagnostic exam ACT Compass. And then school MCA science requires a waiver from federal mandate. So they have recommended that we reduce and actually get rid of a lot of these ACT assessments, some of which are going away anyway, so we are not going to be able to use them. We've been hearing from schools, including the Albert Lea area schools, that these tests in many cases are counterproductive, the ACT tests. They're a one-size-fits-all. Not every student needs to take those assessments. One of my testifiers is ill today, but she is a special ed director and has exactly right in here that a one-size-fits-all does not work. She's got many special ed students because the ACT is a timed test, is very stressful for those students, and it's just not working out. From the Winona Area Public Schools, Amy Adams, Kelly Halverson, who is an administrator there, they're assessing on April 28th 220 juniors with the ACTs. Because of the requirements of the ACTs, they have to send the rest of their students home. Those students are losing out on a whole day of instruction. We're just hearing right now that we have over-testing going on, and I really believe we need to listen to our schools and ratchet back on these. I don't want to swing too far at this point, but I think, you know, this merits doing this right now so that we can accommodate our schools. I believe the MCAs are giving us the information we want. In this bill, we're asking that it would provide a little bit more of guideline-type information, and I'm very willing to work with you, Representative Mariani, and Ms. Larson, I think, would be a good help, too, to get some language in this bill that we make sure that the intent is clear that these are not cut scores.
Okay.
So,
well, thank you, Madam Chair, and
Representative Mariani.
Again, your own witness, Ms. Williams, argued that we see value in the ACT, but aligning it, we see value in the ACT. We don't see that. I'm paraphrasing. We don't see value in a summative test, particularly one that is administered in the spring. The issue of overtesting, I would argue, was not created by our desire to arm students with an empowered diagnostic set of information. The problem with overtesting has to do with the NCLB-dominated assessment frame, one in which we sought to do some independence from, and quite frankly, we've been stymied as a result of a private vendor, you know, and frankly, Madam Chair, as a result of a department, in my opinion, that hasn't pushed hard enough and followed the letter of the law that Governor Dayton signed that we constructed. So that's the pickle. You know, I think if you ask people, they'll tell you get rid of the MCAs. You know, but we can't. We can't get rid of the MCAs because we're stuck in this NCLB accountability system. And so I just want to be really careful that as we go forward in this discussion, that we don't throw out the embedded concepts of why we went with the ACT approach, which has to do with providing diagnostic, real-time information connected to the very real, relevant career and college expectations that each and every student has. And we may need to go this route in some way or another, but let's not lose track of that empowerment approach that we have, that we at least envision over the last few years relative to our assessment system.
Well, Representative Mariani, be sure you read the department bill because there is a huge deletion of what you've been referring. So, the compass has been deleted by the commissioner. So, please be aware of that. Mr. McHenry, any comment to any of that?
Madam Chair, again,
we look forward to your bill on Thursday.
We look forward to the conversation.
Have a great discussion.
Thank you,
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got some comments and suggestions for Representative Bennett on the lines 6.10 to 6.16, the Minsky issue. First of all, in order to do this, we would really have to have a commitment that the MCAs are not going to keep evolving. You know, in order for Minsky to commit to what those scores would mean for them. So that would be a pretty big change from our recent history, you know, where we've had changing tests and changing scores and all of that. The other issue with the MCAs specifically is the scores on the MCA have not really been designed to break out fine levels of detail in the scores, but rather just aimed really at setting these blocks of proficiency. And I don't know to what extent that's a big deal, but they've been really geared around comparing the student to the grade level proficiency and not so much as a predictive tool for advanced levels of proficiency. So I worry a little bit about the statistical, how exactly Minsky will do that. I think in the bill, if you could just put some language in that, you know, clarifies that this is for guidance purposes, that would be relatively simple to satisfy the issue about the cut score. And then when it goes to higher ed, I expect you're probably going to hear some consternation from Minsky about publishing sort of an expected value of automatic admission. And I don't know if they have that or not. I know the U's got away from that, but so that just you're going to, I think, run into a few roadblocks. I like the idea, basically, you know, that families would have a better idea going forward, especially families that don't have previous college experience in their families. But I think there's going to be some hiccups along the way on that.
Well, Representative Urista, we always like hiccups because then we learn. Thank you. Representative Bennett, closing comments. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one quick question. I wonder if Mr. Bartholomew could come up for a quick question.
Please say your name again for the record and respond.
So one of the interesting things, and I say this with all respect, Representative Mariani, when you speak, I listen. And one of the things that he talked about was the alignment study. Do you have any information on that alignment study?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, to the best of my knowledge, the only publicly available information is a two-page notice that the department posted on their website this last fall that basically stated that I believe, my apologies, this is off memory, that they did do an alignment study. As Mr. McHenry said, the details are not public, but as a result of that alignment study, there was not sufficient alignment between the standards and the ACT products, and so that partly, I think, drove the department's decision to require both sets of tests, the MCAs as well as the ACT products.
So Mr. Bartholomew, will you say your name again for the record, just so we know?
Sorry, Madam Chair. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership.
Representative Crescia, further question?
No, just a comment. Thank you for that. I mean, it just seems like there's a lot of information we haven't gotten our hands around yet that may or may not be clearly laid out in front of us. And so thank you for that.
And members, those are excellent questions to ask on Thursday when the department presents its policy bill and their very large testing section. Representative Bennett, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for the good discussion. And I have listened to those things and will attempt to get some language in here that will help, especially with the making sure that these are not cut scores, because that is absolutely not the intent of this bill. I'm just excited to help schools. You know, we need to really listen to schools. I think they're the boots on the ground that are using this information. Also want to just thank the governor for his recent comments too, that would ask for the reduction of these same tests. So I thank you all for listening, and we'll look forward to more work on this bill and moving forward.
And thank you, Representative Bennett, for listening to the test reduction group that the governor did appoint, or not appoint actually, but put in place. I think that you have tried to follow those recommendations, and that was a wide array of folks who were giving you input. So thank you. Members, with that, I'll renew Representative Bennett's motion that 1392 be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Ed. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to higher ed. Representative Quam. And if there are any testifiers here for Representative Quam's bill, would you come forward, please? Welcome to our committee, Representative Quam. I will move House File 475 to be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Please begin.
Thank
and
you,
introduce
Madam.
Yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dwayne Quam, represent House District 25A. And this bill is basically to address an issue that I became aware of over the years talking with FFA members when they come up here to the Capitol, and that there are many schools that are losing their ag programs, losing their FFA chapters. There are multiple school districts that are having to share an FFA chapter, and it's just very difficult to find a licensed instructor to take a 0.3 position in Greater Minnesota because it's difficult to make a living and many college students that go forward in ag education actually go and work in the private sector to earn a living. This bill addresses the fact that even though we've had community experts available for years, a lot of the best agronomists and community experts in the ag industry are salaried personnel, and many of them are not allowed to have a second part-time job to be able to help out the school districts and teach there. So this would allow for multiple community experts to cover an ag program on a corporate partnership with a local ag business. And I'll stand for questions.
Representative Urusso, do you have a question for Representative Quam?
Yes. Trying to figure out how to put it in the form of a question here. Representative Quam, excuse me. Representative Quam, have we ever done anything like this before where we have somebody who's paid by some private interest serving as an instructor in the schools?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Urusso. I know that there have been many corporate initiatives that have brought experts on a volunteer basis to do special programs. I don't believe, and that's why we've got a bill to allow it, I don't believe there's been a formal instruction. I'm more familiar with rotating adjunct people in college, but I think they're paid there. So, no, I don't think there's an existing history.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really don't have a problem with it as, you know, the FFA or the 4-H advisor. That's no different than the Explorer posts and whatnot for a lot of careers where you do have a lot of professionals that come in and volunteer their time. And there's occasional programs like visiting wizards from 3M that go in and do chemistry and physics demonstrations at schools. But, and I understand that we've heard before about the shortage of ag teachers and the difficulty, because it's, maybe just one class in a school. But I'm really concerned that this is kind of a slippery slope here of having a person paid by a corporate entity or some business doing instruction in school. And we had schools that ran into problems with when they had that News One, whatever that Channel One thing was. We start to cross a line there. And I'm not happy about that line, crossing this for this. And I don't know if there's some other way that we could structure this. But if you're actually on paid time in there every day, you're representing your company's interests. You have to, because you're on paid time. So that's I have concerns about it. Thanks.
Well, Representative Urusso, one of my former senators, while he served in the legislature, was our ag teacher. And our district did invite in those who were experts in agriculture to cover for Senator Davis while he was here, because there was no one else to use in the classroom. And I occasionally went in as a licensed substitute during my conference period to assist. But it has been done, and that person or those persons actually received no pay. Representative Quam, did you want to respond to Representative Urusso?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand your concern. I personally was a salaried person and did, I think, 18 different school districts. I volunteered as we had mentorship programs. We had, science fairs. We did engineers. And there isn't really a lot of options when you get to Greater Minnesota And unfortunately, the you know, when you have being on a school board and you've got a point, three position, there's not enough pay to allow a person to really, live out there, and that's their only income. And ag is so big and important to the history and to the present life and so much of Minnesota. I'm looking for a way to maintain that. I'm very open if you've got suggestions of another way, but the crux of it is the more highly educated ag professionals tend to be salaried, and it's very common not to. They can volunteer all they want, but they can't officially work for, and maybe there's some special program, but again, this is if there's a licensed professional, they automatically get the position before you go to community experts.
Madam Chair. Representative Russo.
Thank you. One difference is that when you go in and volunteer, you're not the person who ends up in charge of the kids and assigning grades and whatnot. And I think what we really need to do is just work out some kind of creative contract, to make this happen. And I don't, so I don't know who you can consult with, what we could figure out, but there's got to be a way to do it. But just to make sure that we figure out a way for that person to be, to have a contractual relationship with the school in some way that would clarify that.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you. Madam Chair, are student teachers paid? Is there a stipend that they get or that
No, Mr. Chair, there's not. They are not.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's part of their educational process of higher ed.
So, Madam Chair and members, this is going to another committee. I'm open if there's some way we can utilize a similar situation with student teachers programs to where there would be a teacher assigned maybe as a substitute teacher type, pay and position that would oversee. I'm open to being creative. It's just there's such a need, and we need to be creative and find a solution because our communities and students need something done.
Thank you, Representative Quamp. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a city girl, but I went to a land-grant college and became very familiar with a lot of agriculture, still very connected with it in some ways, and have a great deal of sympathy for the situation that I think we're facing not only in agriculture, which is probably the, the canary in the coal mine kind of thing, with teacher shortage. So I'm wondering if we can't, in these conversations, look at what you're asking for as some short-term solutions, being really creative, but also keeping within the guidelines of teacher licensure to be sure that kids are getting qualified leadership in the classroom and good academics, and also to be inspiring them to go to our land-grant colleges and become agriculture teachers. We're still not talking about the pipeline of getting more people into the classroom, and it's really hard when we're competing with industry. It keeps coming up. They go where the jobs are better paying. So maybe there's something we can do about that, too.
Well, Representative Quam, community experts have to follow the curriculum. So they are held account to that because they are also testing our students, and they are being observed, I think, very carefully by school personnel. So there is accountability there. Representative Dabney. Oh, Representative Ward, follow up.
Yes, just a quick one. And I think in that conversation we need to be talking about embedding some of the curriculum in other classes so that teachers in, for instance, a farming community are covering some of the same curriculum in their classes, just because that's part of the culture. And it's a way of keeping that culture alive so that we don't lose it. But it doesn't necessarily just have to be a separate class in agriculture. It's something that can be embedded in the curriculum without losing any content or rigor.
And Representative Ward, when we hear the department bill, they've done some clarifying of teaching agriculture and the credits that we are awarding in other academic areas through that. So I think you'll be interested in seeing it's some very good clarifying language. Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Quam, I'm confused about a couple of aspects of the bill, and I think I'm focused on lines 1.13 and 1.4 that prohibits the school district from compensating the company, corporation, or sponsored non-licensed community expert. If I currently work for
Monsanto.
Thank you. Fine. It's on the list. So I currently work for Monsanto. I'm instead of doing whatever I do for them, I now am teaching the ag class at the local high school. Who am I employed by?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would say you're employed by, the company. The confusion can be relieved a little bit in that this allows for multiple members. Sort of if you've got your ag curriculum has a horticulture, and maybe it has small animal husbandry. You could have a community expert that's a large animal vet teach one. You could have a community expert that is part of an agronomist for your local elevator. When you get Greater Minnesota, generally it's your local elevator and maybe a ag industry company. Not so much the multinationals having a site out in, please forgive me, out in the middle of rural where there's nothing larger than maybe a 500 resident city around. I mean, a lot of these districts are very sparse in population, and there aren't a lot of other options, and that's part of the problem is that it's a part-time job with a few hours, and that is why licensed staff aren't attracted to it.
Representative Daphne.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam, then these individuals would not be held accountable to all of the policies that the school district, the school board had passed to cover employees, policies relating to data privacy for students, policies related to staff attendance, policies related to computer use and technology, all the usual big book of employee policies. These instructors would not be accountable to them because they would not be employees of the district?
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, having been a school board member, not as long, the 16 years that some of our peers have been, but having been a school board member, having volunteered in multiple school districts, we have policies that, and we have agreements with volunteers that they fall underneath the policies and procedures of the district while they're volunteering at the school district. So therefore, they have to meet those same policies because that's what the board requires of volunteers and the agreements for people to come in and volunteer. A lot of that has been pushed by unfortunate circumstances in some locations, some of those not even in our state, that require us to make sure our volunteers fall underneath those guidelines and procedures. So I hate to contradict you, but from my experience and understanding, is that they would, if they're community experts coming in and doing that, fall underneath those procedures, guidelines, and policies, just as others have before them.
Representative Jaffe.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I'm not sure it's quite as simple and straightforward as you're presenting it, because I'm not an employee of the district. I'm therefore not under the employment policies of the district. Would I be a member of the bargaining unit?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think if you look at the existing standards of the community expert, look at some of the short-term substitute teaching, that would probably be a better guideline. I'm not an expert at PELRA. I think it's a complex system, so I think that would fall underneath you know, those statutes.
Representative Quam, I'm going to lay this bill over, and if you would work out these issues by Friday, we could bring it up again. Otherwise, I think I'm going to say good morning to 1392. So, members, this bill is laid over. Representative Kreisha. 1220.
Is she in the audience? Well, we'll kind of lay this over and come back to it.
Representative Kreisha, please move your House File 1220 to be referred to the Committee on K-12. And what may happen here is we'll hear the bulk of your testimony, and then we might have to come back to this bill later, because Representative Keel is here, and I think she has testifiers, and we would like to proceed there, too. So will
Thank
you please move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would you just like me to move my bill and I can step away?
No, we have testifiers here who can only be here this morning.
Thank you,
so
Madam Chair.
So please move.
I will move House File 1220 to be referred to Committee on Education Finance.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Please explain your bill.
So I'll be very brief, and I apologize. I had a surprise for you, and it didn't pan out, and that was that Art Rolnick was going to Skype in, but we couldn't get in him to come in for testimony. So he has sent me a summary sheet on his position, and I wanted to share that because, as I told him on the phone last night, we keep hearing his name coming up in committee, and I wanted him to have a chance to exactly say where he is. So I'm going to just read it because I think it's very important, and I'll be brief. But Minnesota has a unique opportunity with its budget surplus to do something transformational for Minnesota's most vulnerable children. And that is exactly what early learning scholarships will do. The research is clear. Early childhood education for our most vulnerable is one of the best public investments Minnesota can make. Based on my research, the ROI is at least 16% per year. However, the research is also clear that the ROI on public investments in early childhood education for middle-class children is very low. It is not transformational. Middle-class children are not the ones who start school far behind their peers and never catch up. They are not the children that are eventually incarcerated and never climb out of the poverty trap. Some early childhood advocates argue that an early learning public school-only option is best. Research suggests otherwise. Researchers find that public and private programs can both be effective. While there are exceptional public school programs in Minnesota, we also have exceptional private school programs. But why do we have to prejudge? The advantage of early learning scholarships is that parents decide which programs work best for their children. If public school programs are chosen by most parents, then most of the scholarship money will go to the public schools. But what if a language immersion program like the highly acclaimed Joyce Preschool opens throughout the metro area? Why would we want to deny parents the option to choose such an outstanding program? Indeed, the early learning scholarships empower and engage parents in their child's education. Research finds that one of the best predictors of a child's success in school is having engaged parents. Again and again, in focus groups with our scholarship parents, we are told that the scholarships not only transform their children, but transform their lives. Lastly, given the need for more early learning infrastructure, we should utilize both private and public programs. And a major investment in early learning scholarships would be a significant financial incentive to build the infrastructure we need. That is how it worked out in St. Paul when the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation scholarships were awarded. Numerous early education programs, both public and private, expanded because parents were now financially empowered. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to make the case for early learning scholarships, Bill. To that point, I will say that most of the time when I come up with my bills, I hope for no opposition. I will say with this bill, I'm actually welcoming all the conversations. And I won't say opposition because as I've talked to these individuals, we're all trying to solve the same problem. And with that, today I'll have some of my friends with me. I'll have some of my friends against me. And I hope by the end of this that I'll be standing with my friends.
So, Representative Kreisha, the two main points of your bill, would you say them again?
Yes. So the bill does a couple of quick things. We are going to allow the Education Commissioner to increase by up to 15% the amount for children enrolled in the three-star parent aware programs and up to 20% the scholarship amount for the children enrolled in the four-star. This is an attempt to address the cap issue. We also allow the Commissioner to award to all qualified families who applied. We are in this bill doing away with Pathway 2 app. Only will only allow Pathway 2 if we've reached all the children with Pathway 1. And to be eligible for the program, the Commissioner can also, with the parent aware out in some areas, they may not have parent aware, so we're allowing the Commissioner to say to those programs, if you have a program that's acceptable by them, that they can use that for the scholarships.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. And as you said earlier, you have those who are for you and those who may question you today. So I'm going to call forward those two testifiers I believe I have listed here, Wendy Webster and Sandy Samar. If they would come forward, they have some concerns, Representative Kreisha, about 1220. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Wendy Webster. Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for this opportunity, committee members. I'm the Director of Community Services for St. Anthony Brighton School District, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Community Education Association and 3- and 4-year-old learners, not only in St. Anthony Brighton School District, but also throughout Minnesota. Thank you for your commitment in the last legislative session to support early learning, and as you're aware, we have more work to do. Throughout the state, Pathway 2 scholarships have allowed increased participation in high-quality early childhood programs, high-quality school-based early childhood programs. However, Pathway 1 scholarships are not an efficient nor an effective way to provide access to high-quality school-based early childhood programs. Elimination of Pathway 2 scholarships without significant increases to school readiness funding would greatly impact and reduce the number of families who have access to high-quality school-based early childhood programs. Parents are choosing school-based programs and qualify for Pathway 2 scholarships. Pathway 2 scholarships allow school districts the flexibility to meet various needs of families in their communities. School districts are currently planning 2015-16 early childhood programs, submitting budget proposals to school boards, and also submitting Pathway 2 applications to the Minnesota Department of Education, detailing how those dollars would be invested. Pathway 2 scholarships also allow school districts the flexibility to expand or enhance early childhood programs based on the specific needs of families. One example of program enhancement or expansion is increasing the percentage of children with high needs in programs and increasing the number of staff in the classroom to support those children. For example, in St. Anthony, we have a child who qualified for and receives a Pathway 2 scholarship, whose parents came to our program in the fall and reported he had been kicked out of two other early childhood programs. The children's parents are both immigrants. He's learning both of their home languages, and he's also learning English at school. With Pathway 2 scholarship dollars, we were able to hire a staff member to directly assist this child with transitions in the classroom, and he remains in our program and is experiencing success in our early childhood classroom. A second example of program enhancement is to stabilize a family's ability to pay tuition in order to support consistent attendance. In St. Anthony, we also have a child who qualified for and receives a Pathway 2 scholarship whose parents came to our program in the fall. The father who had been caring for his daughter is living with ALS and is unfortunately unemployed. The deterioration of his health no longer allowed him to care for his daughter while her mother, his wife, works full-time. They needed a full-time early childhood program for their daughter. They had applied for a Pathway 1 scholarship. They are on the child care waiting list and had limited income to pay for a program. With Pathway 2 scholarship dollars, we were able to use that funding to meet the needs as a family and enroll her in a full-day program. For my colleagues in the Wilmer School District, Pathway 2 scholarships have been a great asset for families. Family liaisons have worked with eligible families to help them choose a quality school-based preschool program that meets the family's needs by providing transportation and working with the family schedules. Without the assistance of Wilmer's family liaisons, I do not believe many of the families served would be able to navigate the barriers to accessing a Pathway 1 scholarship. Even more, families would not be able to afford programming without the scholarship assistance Pathway 2 resources provide. As I mentioned earlier, the elimination of Pathway 2 scholarship dollars without significant increases to school readiness funding would reduce the number of families who have access to high-quality school-based early childhood programs. Thank you for your time and commitment to our youngest learners in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Welcome to our committee. Ms. Samar, please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Sandra Simer. I'm the Head Start Director with Child Care Resource and Referral in Rochester, Minnesota. And it's really a pleasure to address your committee, Madam Chair. And on behalf of the Minnesota Head Start Association, I want to let you know how valuable Pathway 2 scholarships are. And the reasons that they're so valuable is that it allows us time to plan the high-quality interventions for the high-risk children and families that we serve in Minnesota. And also, at this time, Pathway 2 scholarships are not available in all areas of the state. Pathway 1 scholarships are not available in all areas of the state. Well, Pathway 2 are in most areas. So, for example, for planning, we had the opportunity to design a comprehensive summer school program for children in our Albert Lee Head Start Center. Because we had Pathway 2 scholarship dollars available, we were able to say that we're going to plan the summer school program for 15 children, but we did not have to identify those children until after the winter checkpoints. So we assess children in the fall, we assess them in the winter, we use authentic assessment, and we needed to know which children were in most need of summer school based on their trajectory and based on where they would be ready for kindergarten. So we took four-year-old children who would be entering kindergarten in the fall, those children who were not on track yet in the winter. We asked the parents if they'd be interested in their children attending a summer school, and they were very enthusiastic about it. Half these children were children who were English language learners. And as a result of the 12-week intensive summer school, every single child met or exceeded their benchmarks. That was beyond our wildest dreams. And we were really, really pleased about those results. And if we had waited to use Pathway 1 scholarships, we would not have been able to identify those children until later on, until like this time of the year, in order to make that plan. And then in most places, there are no Pathway 1 scholarships available at that time. Another way that we use Pathway 2 scholarships was planning to start another classroom in Rochester. We have a long wait list for children in our Rochester area. And the Rochester wait list included really some high-needs children who had applied late for enrollment in Head Start. So all our enrollment slots were filled with our regular funding. We started a new classroom in December of last year. And one of the children enrolled in that classroom's name was Johnny. Johnny came to the classroom with no experience in a preschool classroom at all. He was already five. And he was going to be age eligible for kindergarten in the fall. Johnny, the teachers identified immediately that Johnny had a hard time seeing. He was playing in the sandbox and he had to bring things right up to his eyes to see them. So as a result of participation in our program, we had Johnny's was referred for evaluation. Johnny received glasses. Johnny had not seen a physician since his birth. As a result of participation in our program, Johnny became up to date in his visits with physicians. Johnny had significant dental decay. Johnny received dental treatment as a result of participation. Johnny was, we made a referral to early childhood special ed for Johnny to begin receiving services prior to his entrance into kindergarten. Johnny became virtually a new child just in the scope of a few weeks. Johnny looked, you would go into the classroom to visit Johnny, he would take his glasses that he was so proud of, and he'd lift them up and he'd say, blurry, clear. So for this little boy, being able to participate in a high-quality setting was very, very important for his future success. So again, I want to thank you all for your commitment, your service to our state, and thank you for supporting early childhood.
Thank you, Ms. Samar. With that, Representative Krisha, I'd like to move on to the Keel bill. We have just like 14 minutes left. So members will lay this over, and I'm hoping those who are in the audience who wanted to support the bill can come back tonight, because we'll be continuing this. Representative Keel, please move House File 1220. Excuse me. Please move 645. 45, yes. No, excuse me. I will move 645 because you're not on my committee anymore. Representative Keel, I move House File 645 and with the intention of laying it over for possible inclusion on this bill. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I miss being on the Education Committee also. Members, this bill has a little personal twist for me, or not even a twist, but an importance to me. In my school district, they happened to, when they were hiring, happened to hire a licensed, experienced teacher, instructor, that had come from Missouri and gone to Nebraska, and then to South Dakota because she was following her husband's jobs. The school hired her, and she promptly took the MTLEs and struggled with them, and was eventually, the superintendent had to remove her from the classroom because of the state rules. Never mind the fact that she did very well on all but a little portion of the math. So the superintendent tried desperately to help her, tutored her. Actually, he was a former math instructor, and said, boy, she knows her stuff. The timing just blocks her, and so she has some trouble with that. Eventually, about a year later, she did pass that test and was back in the classroom. Never mind the fact that we had a lot of parents frustrated because she was such a good teacher and experienced, like I said before, licensed. And it became a very difficult issue for the school district. And when I talk about my hometown of Crookston, this is not the only school district that has dealt with this. My entire district has had major problems with it. I've met with instructors or superintendents and school board members up in Thief River Falls at a group meeting where they all talk about how difficult it is to put teachers in place. I live on the North Dakota border. And so we see often teachers hired from back and forth there. This bill is intended to allow teachers that are licensed to come forward and be able to teach without having to relicense themselves in Minnesota. With that, Madam Chair, I was wondering if it would be possible for Ms. Larson to explain just a little bit about this bill for the members so we get it real clear.
Ms. Larson, I don't know if it's necessary, but
okay,
you can go. That's fine. I think it's pretty self-explanatory.
I know we have short time here, so.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
So if they complete a 3-year probationary period in a single school district, are not discharged or advised of board's refusal to renew, they become eligible for a continuing contract and undergo the criminal background check for non-state residents, they will receive their 3-year probationary period. They will receive their license. Let me hear from your supporters.
I would.
Or your testifiers.
That. Thank you very much.
And very quickly, please, to the point.
Yes, yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Very quickly, we're very much in favor of this bill. We know we have a major issue in this state. I've had more concerns from superintendents who have not been able to bring in teachers that are licensed. They've talked with individuals across the borders from other states, and because of the current process, they have been discouraged. Teachers have not applied. We're pleased that this bill has bipartisan support, and we believe that this would be just one additional tool that would go into the toolbox for school districts to use in bringing in qualified, licensed teachers. It's important to note, and I just want to reemphasize what the chair said, this bill is for out-of-state teachers who are already licensed.
Yes.
They are already licensed in another state. They would come into the state of Minnesota. The school boards would then have, with the administration, working with the teacher under our teacher development evaluation process, 3 years to truly determine if that person was of high caliber and was the type of a person that would best meet the needs of the children. Anytime during that 3 years, as with probationary teacher, that person could be removed or let go from the district. So we believe this empowers our districts. We believe that this provides a tool for our administrators to bring in licensed teachers. And again, we're very supportive of this bill and would stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Amoroso. Welcome, Ms. Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Denise Dietrich. I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify on House File 645. We support House File 645 due to the fact that we have been predicting a teacher shortage in the state of Minnesota for over 10 years, and now we are experiencing it. One of the contributing factors that we have heard from school districts around the state is that they are having a difficult time hiring and retaining high-quality licensed teachers from other states. Why? The reasons are varied and are very complex. However, what we have heard over and over again is that fully licensed, highly qualified teachers from other states have found the requirements in Minnesota a deterrent from coming to Minnesota, or so frustrating that they quit the process. As this cycle persists, what is happening is we are reducing the pool of teachers that school boards and superintendents have to choose from. And we all know that when you don't have a healthy, robust pool of candidates, that diminishes your ability to hire a high-quality person. So school board members, superintendents, principals, and community members have felt helpless in this process. And I just want to remind members that in 2011, the Minnesota legislature acknowledged the need to increase the number of teachers from outside the state of Minnesota so that we could recruit from other states by amending Minnesota Statute 122A.23, and that would require the Board of Teaching to create a streamlined procedure to recognize the experience, performance, and training of out-of-state teachers. To this day, there has been no visible progress made on that legislative change. And I just have to say that I think it is to no fault of the Board of Teaching. If you look at the number of bills that have been introduced this year that reference the responsibilities of the Board of Teaching, and if you have listened to their testimony, you will see that they are overburdened. And this is one of the reasons that we support House File 645 is because it reduces the burden on the Minnesota Board of Teaching. It treats out-of-state licensed teacher like a probationary teacher. At that point, they are at-will employees. They can be let go anytime. And the most important reason that we support it is that it provides it allows the decision to be made, hiring decision to be made closest to those who are held accountable for that decision. And it allows a three-year process to evaluate the performance of that teacher. And we all know that what happens in the classroom is very important. What happens in the classroom measures things that tests cannot. It measures an energy of a candidate. It can measure your organization, your cultural competence, professional behaviors, classroom management, teamwork, work ethic, creativity, problem solving, passion, and the list goes on and on. But that gives the school board members and professionals the ability to observe those behaviors in the classroom. So with that, Madam Chair, that this is a very complex problem, and this is one approach to solving this problem, but it will take, we do acknowledge that it will take many approaches to solving this problem. But we do believe that this issue deserves the attention of policymakers this legislative session.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Are there others who would like to speak very briefly in support? Mr. Dunham?
Yes.
Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members, Josh Downham of the Minneapolis Public Schools. We support House File 645. This past year, Minneapolis schools hired 500 new teachers, and next year we project to need an additional 350 teachers. As you know, 4% of graduates from Minnesota teaching colleges are teachers of color. Yet in Minneapolis, 67% of students are students of color. We do have 16% of our teachers who are teachers of color, but we need to look beyond the borders of Minnesota for qualified teachers of color. And this bill will help simplify and streamline that process. And it allows us, just like our probationary teachers, to evaluate these teachers four times a year, both by their peers and administrators, to ensure that they are meeting the standards that we set, and where not, they get the professional development, targeted professional development, to help improve their craft. So we appreciate Representative Keel bringing this bill forward, and hope you include it in the policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Denham. And committee will resume discussing this bill this evening. We will be going into recess, and we will resume at 6 p.m. in room 5. So please put all of your files back into the folder so that we are ready. We have rules coming in here very shortly. And members, when we pick this bill up later this evening, I will be changing the motion to refer it to the Committee on K-12 Finance, because I guess they want to see it and hear it also. So members, with that, this meeting is in recess.